Hello, my name's Tamsin Westhorpe and welcome to Fresh from the Pod Gardening Stories. Now, growing our own fruit, veg and herbs remains right at the top of our agenda. So I thought it would be fun to speak to someone who's an expert in this field. And she is Anna Greenland. Now, Anna has grown produce for the likes of Raymond Blanc and Jamie Oliver. She learnt her craft in LA, of all places, and she's worked in the kitchen garden at the Lost Gardens of Heligan. Anna is the most fascinating person. I was so excited to hear that she's a career changer. You just wait to hear what career she gave up to grow organic produce. Anna, it's so lovely to have you as a guest on Fresh from the Pod. And I really wanted to start with something I didn't know about you. I didn't know until recently that you gave up an international modelling career to grow vegetables. Why? What? Who? Tell me more.
Oh, goodness. It seems like a thousand years ago now, to be honest with you. But I was scouted, as they say, when I was about 15, kind of quite a predictable story at the clothes show in Birmingham at the NEC. And then, I did modelling sort of in my school holidays when I was at school, and then through university, helped to pay for a bit of it. And then afterwards, I thought I'd give it a shot for a year or two full time just to see how it panned out. But I don't know, I did okay, but it was so competitive and I just felt like it didn't have longevity. You know, maybe if I'd flown to the sort of heights of Kate Moss or, you know, some of the real big earners, then it would have been a different story. But, you know, I did well with it. I got to travel and it was pretty exciting for a time, but I think in the long run, it probably wasn't for me. Felt like there was maybe, you know, there was something else. And I think my parents had always been, they were really supportive, but they'd always sort of said, you know, you've got to get your education under your belt and kind of pushed me in that direction a bit more. So, you know, I wasn't like a lot of the girls that I knew when I was 16 were leaving school at that point to sort of give it their all. And I guess I was always doing it, you know, here and there rather than 100%. And there's all these, you know, amazing kind of Russian girls and so much competition. I'm not sure I would want my daughter to necessarily go into it. Although if she wanted to, I'd have to support her. But it's quite a cutthroat industry for a young person.
But what an amazing experience, and probably it allows you to sort of settle with what you're doing because you've seen the other side, if you see what I mean. It couldn't of a contrast.
That's so true. And I think it made me realise what I didn't want and what I did want. You know, so I was really ready to leave London and to leave that life behind when I moved to Cornwall. And I think, like you say, I sort of got it all out of my system and was very happy to then put down some roots and do something a bit more wholesome, I think.
So when you went to Cornwall, you went to work as a waitress, didn't you, at Jamie Oliver's restaurant 15. And that was really the sort of start of your growing journey, wasn't it? How did that happen?
Yeah. So I moved to Cornwall, wasn't 100% sure what I was going to do down there. I'd met a guy, sort of fall in love, and again, much to my parents' horror, sort of announced that I was moving to Cornwall with no plan. And luckily, Jamie's restaurant just happened to be opening at the same time, and there was a real buzz about it, and they were really championing local produce and local suppliers. And I think it was his ethos and the whole sort of feel of the restaurant at the time that then got me interested in the growing side, because they used to have suppliers coming in and there was a big open kitchen and they'd come in with these big boxes full of wonderful looking tomatoes and beautiful produce that I just hadn't really seen before, apart from, you know, maybe in France, sort of, you know, markets and things, but I hadn't seen, you know, in the UK. And I was just really enticed by it all. And I got in touch with one of the suppliers who had a farm on the south coast of Cornwall called Buttervilla Farm, and he was growing lots of lovely heritage tomatoes and had a small scale sort of organic market garden, really. And him and his wife were just incredibly supportive and giving with their time. And they, you know, I said, have you got any work? Are there any jobs? And they said, well, no, but we have got some land if you wanted to have a go, you know, just have a play around. And, you know, have you got any experience? And I sort of, I guess, lied a little bit. Yeah, no, I didn't really. I mean, my experience, I guess, was my parents are very, well, my mum particularly is very green fingered, my grandmother. So it's very much in the family, my uncles in horticulture. So I spent a lot of time in my childhood, you know, around gardening, and my parents later on had an allotment. So I used to go there a lot. So I think that sort of osmosis happened, but it wasn't until, until Cornwall and when I moved to Cornwall, I had a greenhouse and a little plot of land in the garden. So I had a little bit of experience, but yeah, I definitely had to sort of over-egg it a bit. But I think they soon realised that I was pretty green, and they were very, very giving with their time, taught me a lot. And luckily, you know, with their support, the produce then that I was growing was able to link up with theirs and go on to 15. So it then became a bit of a full-time operation where I was growing sort of during the days, and I, you know, again, I was so enthusiastic, I didn't think things through properly. So I was driving from the north coast where I lived, sort of up, you know, between Padstow and Newquay, all the way down to near Loo, which is sort of the south coast, so best part of an hour to get to this plot of land. Getting there really early in the morning, working all day, and then I would do the sort of delivery. So they'd load up. I think I only had a little Fiesta or something, and we'd just load it to the gunnels with all these boxes, and then I'd drive to the restaurant, drop that off, run in the loo, scrub my nails, you know, scrub the dirt away, and then wait, you know, go out on the floor to waitress in the
gosh
evening.
So you were actually serving plates of food that had produce you'd grown on. Was that a real, that must have been, did you want
amazing.
To say to them, did you want to say, I grew that?
Do you know what, I luckily, what was really fun, they had on the menu, and I've still got them, I sort of kept the first one as a memento, and I think I'm more proud of it than I am of most things, actually. But because it was the sort of Jamie Oliver style, they had everything flagged up, so it was sort of, I think it says Anna's Beets or something.
Brilliant.
So, you know, it was a talking point with the guests, and they really enjoyed the fact that, you know, I could really engage with them about the produce, and that, yeah, that was the buzz, and I think that's what really was the catalyst to sort of say, well, this is, if I feel that happy about, you know, just sharing this with people, then it's enough to kind of pursue this further as a long-term career, really.
So you went from there, how did you end up at Heligan?
So, yeah, I realised that I had a lot to learn, I think, and that I wasn't, you know, as much as I'd, all my learning had been very hands-on on the job, sort of reading books and talking to people, but I felt like I needed a bit more of a sort of education in how to grow kind of by the book, and Heligan sort of vegetable garden is definitely the place to teach you, you know, how to do things properly, I guess. And so I just approached them and you know, in the hope that there might be some work, and yeah, got lucky really and joined the veg team with a kind of sideline role, which was quite interesting, of trying to kind of get there, because they've got now it's beautiful, the kind of canteen and kitchen area there, but they wanted to get more produce from the gardens into the restaurant. And I think with the Jamie Oliver link and everything, they felt like I might be able to help with that. But it was quite a tricky task, because, you know, the garden team wanted to keep the gardens looking immaculate, you know, and didn't want half their rows stripped, you know, it's sort of going up to the kitchens, and then the kitchens were quite set in their ways and didn't particularly want to, I mean, not now, but back then, you know, start using all these big boxes of kind of turnips and things. So I was kind of stuck in the middle of it a bit, but it was a good challenge, and we did make some good changes, and yeah, I just learned so much being there and just kind of soaking it all in, really. I'd realized the scale that I was doing things at Butter Villa, you know, it wasn't kind of particularly, it wasn't about the money, but I was just, really working myself into the ground, you know, scratching a living really, and not that you go into gardening to make, you know, huge amounts of money, but it was pretty, I was putting myself under a lot of pressure. So I think I wanted a good solid gardening job, kind of 9 till 5 is a bit of a change from the madness that had preceded that really.
It's interesting you bring up, you know, that produce is cheap in fact, you know, homegrown, organically, it is cheap when you look at the hours and the time that goes into it.
Yeah.
Do you think that at last people are expecting to pay for it, or do you think that's still a massive hurdle?
It's difficult, isn't it? I still think it probably is, that there is a bit of a stigma still attached to the price of organic produce. You know, I think people are still wary of spending, which, and I always say, you know, even friends of mine who are into kind of health and, you know, eating well, and still don't really prioritize necessarily, you know, sourcing sustainable produce, because they say, oh, it is expensive. And I think, well, you know, if you knew the journey that carrot had been on to get to your plate, you wouldn't think that. I don't know. It's a really good question. I hope that, you know, we're talking a lot more about soil, aren't we? And you know, it's very much more in the mainstream now. And this, the understanding that, you know, soil can capture carbon and that our soils are degraded and that we need to be replenishing them. And, you know, I think that's quite a mainstream conversation now, which it really wasn't, you know, 5 years ago or even a few years ago. So I hope that, you know, through understanding a bit more about where we're at with our soils, that, you know, people will start to understand the importance of well-produced produce, whether it's organic or, you know, just really good, you know, homegrown produce.
And I think the chefs do an awful lot, don't they? I know you went on to work for Raymond Blanc at Le Manoir, which is where we met briefly.
We did.
And I think that, you know, he gets to you through taste. You know, you look at all the varieties and you think, well, it's a beetroot. But then you start to taste them. And I think that's the way to pull people in, don't you? That it's the taste is exceptional.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. You have to be able to make that connection with people, I think, and get, you know, whether it's children, you know, kids or people that haven't tasted that kind of produce. I mean, I personally, you know, I really do think there's a difference in taste. You know, it's sort of incomparable, you know, when you go and pull a fresh carrot or whatever from the ground. It's being able to give people that opportunity to taste that.
Especially if Raymond's cooked it, the taste as well. I mean, it blows your mind.
That's next level, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, what I found lovely is that he is so involved with that garden, isn't he? And did you find that when you worked there? Did you find that, you know, it is his garden and he does know the vegetables? Was that difficult to work with or easy, or did you learn from him? What was the
it was incredible. You know, it was life-changing, that whole experience of working with him. You know, he's such a passionate person, and yes, you know, at times it was testing. No, I don't know what the right word is. I mean, he was incredibly involved to the point where, you know, he would phone me at sort of 11 o'clock at night and say, oh, I've just had this, you know, idea of a variety we could grow that I found in France. You know, there was never a kind of an off, you know, switch off time, because he was, you know, his brain's always working. He's always kind of thinking about it. So it wasn't your standard gardening job in that sense. But he was so involved. You know, he was always sort of first in. Well, I, you know, I'd be in early and he'd come walking through the garden, you know, early coming in, want to know what was happening. You know, I think a lot of chefs sometimes, you know, they'll be kind of a head figure, but they're not as invested in the place. And yeah, he was always sort of trampling through, have to keep him off the veg beds because he was so enthusiastic. He'd come kind of trampling through everything to see what was going on. So we had to keep him on the paths, but yeah.
Keep Raymond under control. That's exactly. Never good.
No, exactly.
But I think he sort of started off this desire for restaurants and people that go to lovely restaurants to see where their food comes from. Do you mm-hmm. think he? Do you think he was at the forefront of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I really think he was. You know, the memoir was probably the first in this country, you know, restaurant that sort of was able to provide that garden to plate experience, and it was sort of the pinnacle, really. You know, and I think he very much invigorated that whole movement, I suppose. And that was, you know, quite a few years ago now. That would have been sort of 70s, late 70s, I guess. I have to check. I can't remember when they first opened it, but maybe early 80s. But he's, yeah, and he's still to this day, you know, he's just still incredibly passionate about those gardens and about, you know, just fresh produce in general and flavour. And when I worked there, one of the main things was taste trialling and taste testing. So every year we'd identify X amount of varieties or vegetables that he wanted to check, and then we'd to test, and then we'd grow all of these different varieties, and then we'd do taste tests, which were a bit like, you know, wine tastings, where it would be myself, another gardener, a couple of his development chefs. And we, you know, it'd be things like with the potato tasting. That was insane because he wanted to get the best potato for kind of roast potatoes, mashed potatoes, boiled potatoes, you know, however you can imagine a potato in a dish. He wanted to identify the key potato that tasted best for that dish. So, you know, then there was the chili tasting, which was hilarious because none of us could taste anything after that, the first one. So an apple tasting, which, you know, he's really passionate about his yes. orchard, and that, you know, again is sort of endless, the amount of varieties that you can taste. So yeah, that was always quite an entertaining part of it, really, and it did shape what we grew the following year, which was good fun.
And you didn't need to take a lunchbox in, by the sounds of it.
No, you could definitely ferret around and
foraging at Le Manoir.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you went to study unusually in LA, am I right?
Yeah, well, I studied in Santa Cruz, which was just, you know, a bit further north, but then got a job off the back of that course in LA. So totally kind of not somewhere where I ever thought I would end up. Having been, you know, in Cornwall for all those years, it can have been more different. But I did the course in America because I'd struggled to find, I wanted to do a course specifically in food production, and I wanted it to be sustainable food production. And there just wasn't, you know, there wasn't the breadth of courses there are available now. You know, I think it's obviously a hell of a lot more on people's radars now. But I'd found this course in America, which just ticked all the boxes, basically. I mean, the only thing was, you know, it was obviously growing in a different climate here in the UK, but, you know, most of the principles could be applied here too. So that was a 6-month kind of, 6-month course where you lived on site, on the farm, in little tents. And you were working on the farm and the gardens by day. You had a few days of lectures as well. So that was at the University of Santa Cruz. And then LA was an urban food growing project that they had set up or were setting up at a big botanical garden, the Huntington Botanical Gardens, which in America everyone sort of knows about, but over here, you know, it's just not really heard of. So you know, I sort of came back saying, oh, I worked at the Huntington Botanical Gardens, and everyone looked very blankly at me.
Where? What?
Yeah, exactly.
But it strikes me that you're very brave, that you've just sort of thought, I'm going to give this a go. Would you say that is you? You know, you're moving around.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm brave. I definitely agonise over decisions. but I think I get itchy feet quite easily. So I'm not, after 2 or 3 years at something, I tend to feel like a change. I mean, maybe now I'm kind of approaching 40, I might be a little bit more willing, you know, to just kind of be. But I think through my 20s and 30s, I was very much like, you know, wanting to kind of get as much experience as I could and try as many different things as I could. I don't know if I'm brave, but I think I like to get stuck in and have a go at things, really.
But then in a way, moving around from Cornwall to Suffolk to LA to Oxfordshire, it's given you this sort of experience of different growing environments, hasn't it? Which must be so useful for you.
Yeah. I think that's been really, like, you know, just having a really diverse range of experience. I think, you know, well, you know, just every garden is different and all soils are different and microclimates. And so, yeah, I think that's been really helpful to get a feel for lots of different situations, really.
And now you've settled in Suffolk. Have you settled in Suffolk, really, Anna?
That's the big question. Yes, I think we definitely have. I mean, God, we're putting so much work into the project that we're doing at the moment. So I don't see us going anywhere for quite some time. I'm an Essex girl, but only about an hour away from my parents now. So, and having had my daughter, you know, in the last kind of 18 months, yeah, I think it's time to put down some roots. So, we're here in Suffolk. We've just taken on, sort of a barn, well, it's an old threshing barn that was very much a ruin, and then there's about an acre of land or an acre and a half of land that comes with the barn, so my husband's out there sort of building away, and then I'm kind of in charge of the gardens, really. So it's a really big project.
So is he into gardening, your husband?
Well, that's a good question. He wasn't. He's very practical. So he likes the sort of, you know, if I ask him to build me a sort of a cage or he put the polytunnel up recently, and he likes getting stuck in. He hates being on his hands and knees and weeding. That's his absolute worst, and planting. He helped me with a garden. I did a little, it was only a small little show garden at Hampton Court a few years ago. And he was, you know, my main planter for that. And I was pointing where I wanted everything. He was down on his hands and knees. He's quite sort of not the most kind of graceful of creatures. And he was like on his hands and knees for hours trying to kind of get all these plants into these tiny spots. And he swore he would never, ever help me again doing anything like that.
Put him off.
Yeah, I put him off for life. But no, he's keen, and he loves, you know, actually it's been really interesting seeing since we've been together. You know, he wasn't at all interested particularly in food, but he gets really excited now about seeing things in the ground and harvesting things. And, you know, he's I hear him talking to other people, you know, saying, oh, you know, we've got this growing, and I can hear his enthusiasm. So it's, you know, I think it's, once you experience it, it's like you were saying earlier, it's a bit addictive, you know. Once you've tasted something like that, then it's hard to go back. So so I'm definitely going to be roping him in to helping me wherever possible, really.
So the dream is that you live in the barn, I take it.
Yes.
And you create a market garden that you use for courses, teaching. Is that the sort of ultimate aim? And do you have a time scale or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think hopefully, well, the barn, the living sort of space will be finished hopefully by this summer. I'll be getting cracking as soon as possible with the gardens, as of now, really. And then I guess, I mean, you know, obviously COVID has thrown everything.
Yes.
Into a bit of a spiral for everyone, but you know, I would love to be able to be offering courses and up and running for next year. So not 2021, but 2022. But we'll have to see what happens. I mean, the other thing now is obviously online courses and things, which are becoming more popular. So, you know, there is a chance that I can use the gardens as a base for something like that. But I wanted to do something, you know, interactive. And we've set aside a sort of a teaching space, teaching area as part of the barns. And my dream was to sort of have people come and learn, you know, the basics of how to grow their own food, basically, and create a little hub here in Suffolk. But Yeah, I'm still hopeful that we can do that. It's just
you'll get there.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, I love your Instagram. You're very good at creating this community and a learning environment through social media. And now I know your past, you know, from your modeling, you know how to do a photo shoot. Your food looks amazing and everything all looks really dreamlike, so you do an amazing job with that.
Well, thank you. It takes so much time, that's the thing. I mean, it's, you know, you do sometimes wonder, it's that whole thing with Instagram of, you know, do you just literally post a picture straight off the cuff, you know, a few words, bang, gone. You know, sometimes maybe I think that's more, I don't know, more real or more engaging than sort of spending ages trying to get everything to look nice. But I don't know, I think both ways work. But it's nice to sort of, yeah, I like that creative process of kind of making a nice looking feed, I guess.
Yeah, and what I've loved during lockdown, when your little girl Bonnie was a bit smaller, it was just brilliant. You've got her sort of strapped to you like a papoose. It was, they're called like a scarf.
Yeah,
and you were just carrying on regardless. And I thought, this is just brilliant, because
you know what, I had so much energy there. It was so weird. It must have been the hormones. I mean, now I just don't. I don't know how. I look at those videos and I think, how did I do that? Because I'm sure I was just, yeah, I was high on all the post sort of pregnancy birth hormones. Because she was, yeah, we were doing video as soon as the first lockdown happened. You know, we didn't know what, you know, there was nothing we could do really here. All the building work stopped, everything ground to a halt. So it felt like a great time to share what, you know, we were doing on a small scale in the garden here. But we had quite a relentless kind of schedule of, you know, videos every day. And then it was, people were really engaging with it, which was lovely. But, you know, that kind of spurred us on to keep doing. So my husband was filming, and yeah, Bonnie was sort of just gurgling away in the background, or yeah, just strapped on. But yeah, it is funny, just the amount of, I don't know if I could keep that kind of level, that pace up right now.
Yeah. But have you found, I mean, I have a son and it's a lot, you know, he's 15 now, but I do remember when he was smaller, how hard it is, because you know, you've got two dreams, haven't you? You want to be a perfect mum, but you also want to keep your career going. And I feel it's important that children see their mums doing things and making their dreams come true. But has it been a difficult balancing act?
It really has, actually. Yeah. And I agree with everything you said. Yeah. I mean, I think it's that age old problem, isn't it, for mothers, really, in trying to juggle that with work. But I think luckily, you know, the work that I'm doing, I hope, whether Bonnie will just go off and want to be a sort of computer programmer or something, but I hope that, not that, you know, there's anything wrong with that, but I hope that, you know, she, being around the plants and being around gardening and, you know, absorbing everything that I'm doing, it's a very sort of wholesome, healthy pastime, and a world for her to be around. So it's good, you know, that I'm able to sort of have her in tow a bit, to a degree, although, to be honest, now she's walking and pulling off flower, you know.
Yes, that's the hard bit.
Destroying everything. I think, you know, there's got to come a point where, yeah, she's just not sort of with me the whole time, really. But yeah, it's been hard. And, you know, I have been writing a book this last year. My family have been amazing, sort of helping to look after her. And my husband's been great. But yeah, I've had that guilt, you know, the mother's guilt of, oh, I'm not spending enough time with her, you know, and I'm missing out on things. But I think, exactly what you said, I think if I wasn't doing what I, you know, wanted to, felt was fulfilling me, then I feel like I wouldn't be as good a mum to her. But everyone, you know, everyone has a different experience, really.
It's interesting. I remember when I was working at Amateur Gardening magazine, one of the designers said to me, and she was older than me, I was feeling guilty coming to work. And she said, just get used to it. You know, that guilt is part of motherhood. You're guilty if you're not there. You're guilty if you are there and you're not working. And I think that was a really good bit of advice, because, yeah, I mean, you just have to fit everything in somehow. And I remember my son said to me a while back, I was doing a talk and he was there, and he said afterwards, "Oh, I'm really proud of you, Mum." And I just thought, oh gosh, it's all worth it. It is all worth it. So
that's so nice. I think
you're doing the right thing, forging ahead.
Yeah.
But the book, I mean, that your book isn't coming out yet, is it? So
no, not till September. But it's my first gardening book, basically. So I'll be able to sort of talk more about it in the future. But it's been quite a process. I mean, I know you've written books, and you know, you can probably vouch for the fact that it's just all consuming, really.
Definitely.
when you're in it. And I had no idea, really, you know, the undertaking that I was sort of taking on, and you know, have so much respect now, having gone through that process for authors, you know. I've been thinking about doing something for quite a long time, but I think finally got to it, really. And I've enjoyed, you know, it's like that love-hate relationship with writing, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't it? But, you know, when I'm sort of in the flow of it, and now that I've finished it, I can say that, you know, I enjoyed the process, but there's times where, you know, it's like pulling teeth, or you're just not quite in the right headspace to be writing, and it's not coming, you know, not flowing out very well. And, you know, it's very tough. There's always 1,000 distractions.
Yes. You can see why in movies, you know, they always have the author, don't they, sitting by a river in a lovely little cottage all on their own. You think, oh, that would be just heaven. But that is not reality, unfortunately.
No.
You also have a blog. You've got a lovely website. Your blogs are great. And I loved, you've got a few things here I wanted to mention. So nettle and rosemary hair tonic.
Oh, yeah.
You make all these amazing herbal and tasty things.
Yeah.
And are these things that you sort of invent as you go along or have experiments with?
Yeah. I mean, I got really interested in herbs. I think it was working with Raymond that herbs kind of really came to the fore for me, obviously in a culinary sense, but also he had a medicinal garden. It was just a border in the vegetable garden, but it was his Maman Blanc, ode to Maman Blanc, little medicinal garden. And, you know, he'd grown up with her, you know, using herbs to treat any ailments and things. And so that kind of got me first thinking about using herbs in a medicinal sense. I mean, I'm definitely, you know, I'm not a herbalist. I don't profess to be one at all. You know, I just use them for certain things. So, you know, standard kind of kitchen herbs, like sage or rosemary or thyme, things that, you know, might, those particular herbs like could have in tea, you know, like sage is very good for sore throat, or and thyme as well is good for sort of winter coughs and colds and things. So, you know, it's just thinking about those everyday herbs that we use so often in our cooking, but when you delve into them a little bit more, you discover that they've got all these wonderful kind of health-giving properties as well. So I've just then started sort of playing around with making you know, different skin balms and hair rinses. And, you know, it's not something I haven't replaced every single, you know, product that I own with homemade remedies. I wish I was that kind of superwoman, but no, it's just a fun kind of hobby, really. To, you know, I think if you like cooking, which I do, you know, playing around with kind of herbal remedies as well in the kitchen is really fun. I mean, definitely something I have more time for pre-baby.
But again, I think things like that, when you open a blog up, you may not be, you know, an accomplished gardener, gardening may be new, but you see these things like herbal honey salt scrub and you think, oh, and then you start reading it. And then I think it's a different way of getting people involved, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And engaging people with plants. And yeah, I think that's it. That's what I find fascinating about herbs. You know, it's only when you think about, you know, our kind of history as humans, you know, it's only relatively recently that we've transitioned away from herbal medicine. And, you know, and thank goodness, you know, in many ways we've got all these brilliant new drugs, but that doesn't mean that some of the old remedies aren't really, really useful and really work and could be really supportive. And it's, and that kind of thing, for me, I love herbs in that they kind of connect you to another world and to the past, and you start delving into all of the old herbals and just, yeah, wonderful kind of in illustrations and accounts of how people were using these plants through the years, really. So it's just kind of a fascinating world to delve into.
Yeah, it's exciting. And obviously, you're an organic grower. So people are going to be saying, Tamsin, now ask her, how does she do this? Because it's not the easiest route, is it, to be an organic gardener and to grow produce for restaurants that have to be absolutely top class. So, I mean, is there a lot of waste? What are the techniques? You know, if you're growing lettuce and you've got to present it to a top restaurant, what's the biggest pest and how do you get around it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always grown that way, so I don't know any different in a way. But I think the key thing is sort of creating a really healthy ecosystem. So, you know, growing lots and lots of different plants. You know, you think about the Manoir garden, you know, we had big borders of herbs and rows of different vegetables, fruit trees, you know, in close proximity. So, you know, it's getting that kind of really vibrant ecosystem thriving, so that when you do get pests and problems, you know, it's not going to necessarily take out everything. And there's these kind of natural checks and balances, really. And I guess the key thing is the soil. You know, if you've got a healthy, really healthy soil, then that's going to make your plants more robust. But of course, like you say, you know, lettuce crop, if you've got slugs, then, you know, yeah, of course, they're going to kind of take out your lettuces. But it's kind of planning it so that, you know, you haven't got things growing right next to your lettuces that have got lots of overhanging leaves where they're going to lurk, you know, keeping the weeds down, you know, being very on it with kind of weeding at the right time so that you've got nice clean soil around your plants. And I start a lot of things in plugs. I use modules a lot rather than direct sowing, you know, straight into the ground, because that then gives you a really good head start. So I'd never sow, I mean, unless it was maybe some baby leaf mix or something, but I would always sow into plugs for lettuce, and then plant them out, you know, so that they're a little bit more robust. And that's the same for a lot of the things that, you know, I'll start in module trays and then plant them out. So I think that's a good tip, because it does sort of mean that you're a little bit further ahead. You know, things like carrots are difficult because obviously they're coming through as tiny little seedlings and slugs can be an issue. But again, I suppose, just ensuring that you've got a nice sort of clean, you know, weeded area to start with before you sow, if it's something like carrots, and just keeping on top of the weeding. Healthy soil, so lots of good compost or green manures. Yeah, and lots of diversity, I think, is the key with organic gardening. Okay. So, yeah, I always have at the ends of every bed, you know, as close to vegetable rows as possible, you know, as I say, lots of flowering herbs, flowering plants, you know, or cut flowers or whatever it is. So there's a real mix going on to bring in all the beneficial insects and the pollinators. And then also, you know, using, there's now, you know, we're really lucky, there's lots of different kind of materials that you can use to protect crops. So, you know, things like fleece or insect mesh, you know, is a good one. So if you're growing brassicas, you can throw some of this very fine mesh over them to stop cabbage white butterflies.
And there's always one gets under ours. I don't know how. It's like, come on.
I know, it's so true. Yeah, you can never, I mean, I think that's the thing, isn't it, with growing in a kind of natural organic way, you know, you've got to accept that you're going to lose a proportion of what you grow. But I don't really mind that, because I, you know, of course, yeah, it's heartbreaking if you've spent time, you know, sowing something and, you know, it's just about to kind of take off and then you come back and something's nailed it. But generally speaking, you know, I think you can take a few losses, you know, if you know that you've got this healthy kind of, you know, garden that you're tending and you're improving the soil. And
but do you find
go a bit
when you're talking to chefs, you know, if you're offering a consultation about growing for a restaurant, do you find sometimes that there's a lack of understanding with seasonality, quantities, you know, because you're not a machine, are you? It is sort of vulnerable to all sorts of different factors. So is it ever possible, do you think, to completely be, for a restaurant to be completely self-sufficient or not?
Well, no, I mean, this was a big sort of thing at Soho House that we, you know, that I think that people look at a space like a, you know, a good sized vegetable garden and they think that's absolutely vast and that you can grow everything. But as you know, you need acres and acres really to make a real dent in, especially in a really busy restaurant sort of production. And there's always going to be things that a restaurant needs to, but you know, that generally they want sort of avocados and they want, you know, other things that you can't be 100%. But I think, you know, you can manage expectations by saying, you know, through the summer month or from sort of spring through till, or late spring, you know, through till early autumn, you're going to have, you know, really sort of daily, or, you know, twice, I mean, most places I've worked, you know, you do sort of a couple of main harvests a week, and then, you know, all the little bits every day, like edible flowers and microgreens and fresh salads and things. But you know, you can kind of tell them that, you know, you're going to have all of their kind of side dishes and, you know, main vegetables can kind of come out of the garden, but all the extra bits, you know, like at the Manoir they had to buy in extra, in terms of, I think, things like potato and onions and, you know, those basic crops, you know, prioritize, you know, what are the things that, you know, maybe the flavor is, the flavor of an onion so different, you know, from a shop bought one to a, maybe not, so let's focus on, you know, all of the lovely salad leaves, the beetroots, the you know, the different colored beetroots, all of the different varieties of things that you just can't get hold of, you know. But I think, yeah, to answer your question, it is really difficult to be completely self-sustainable unless you, in a kitchen garden scale, you know. I think if you were to have a farm, which there are places doing, you know, there are places doing that now, I think then that's maybe more realistic.
So are you hoping that the new flurry of excitement of growing your own will remain? Do you think that when people start going back to, if we do, back to our normal lives, do you think that people will still grow their own? What's your feelings?
I really hope so. I think so. I would say, you know, once you've done it, you know, and you get the bug, then it's something that's sort of with you for life, really. And once you've tasted that produce, you know, it is hard to go back. I suppose, you know, a lot of it is time for most people, and you know, people have had more time because they've been at home, and that's meant that they've been able to spend more time in their gardens. But I like to think that, you know, that just generally at the moment there is a feeling that people are more environmentally conscious. You know, that's not going away. I think people are really keen to understand where their food's coming from, and I don't think it's a flash in the pan. Like I do think it's going to carry on.
And what I've loved watching on Instagram and social media is mums using the garden as an educational location. Yes. You know, a break from homeschooling, let's sow some seed, let's count these potatoes. Yes. And that is fantastic, isn't it? That's got to be good.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting kids involved is, I mean, that's a real joy, isn't it? That's, you know, that kind of childish wonder at, you know, the things that we kind of take for granted, but they just can't believe it when you're pulling a potato out of the ground or a carrot. It's pretty amazing.
Magical.
I think it's still here. You know, I saw my neighbor this morning and he said that he's been trying to order a greenhouse, just a standard greenhouse, and it's about a 16 week lead time on it or something. So he can't get a greenhouse for love nor money.
Brilliant.
So I think, yeah, there's obviously, and seed, you know, again, seed, I wondered this year whether it would be the same as last year with the seeds. And I've tried a few sites, and yeah, it's the same thing. Everything seems to be, I don't know about every company, but some of the companies that I use, you know, they're completely at capacity, and have closed their shops and things. So good.
I mean, it is good. It's good.
It's difficult for, I think people don't realise, you know, particularly new growers, that one packet of seeds goes a long way, you know, and there's this feeling that you've got to suddenly bulk buy everything. And, you know, it means that there's not that many left for everyone, which is a shame.
Oh, well, Anna, I mean, it's been so interesting talking to you. I think your career is, well, it's just, it's really unique, you know, that you've changed path, you've travelled a lot, you've worked with these most amazing people. And I can't wait to see what you do next with your new plot of land.
Thank you.
Really exciting. And yeah, keep us entertained on your Instagram.
I'll try. No, thank you, Tamsin. It's been really lovely talking to you as well. You've, yeah, was been an inspiration to me. So yeah, that's lovely.
Oh, bless you. Very nice to speak to you. Happy gardening, Anna.
Thank you. And you. Bye.
I just found Anna's career story movie worthy. What an amazing story to give up a career as a model to grow fruit and veg. It's absolutely lovely and I wish her every success. Now, inspired by Anna, I'm going to be taking over the @CandideUK Twitter account on Friday the 18th of February, where I hope to open up the conversation about changing your career into one in the horticultural industry. I'd love to hear from you if it's something you dream of or something you have succeeded with. I'll be there from 6:45 to 7:45. I'd love you to be part of the conversation. In the meantime, happy gardening.